So let's continue on with our scouting report. This could be our last big one, but definitely had to do it. An intriguing prospect, maybe one who gets a little bit overlooked just because he's not this amazing scorer, probably the worst scorer of any of the bigs that we have looked at, but a really intriguing prospect nonetheless. Jaren Jackson Jr. out of Michigan State. Where do you want to start in talking about his game, Danny?
Well, I think let's start just with the basic physical profile. So at the combine, he measured 6'11", 236 pounds with a 7'5 wingspan, and he has big hands for those who care about that. And so the way that I would describe Jaren Jackson, I was talking about this with a few people as I watched his footage over the last little while, is that he, to me, is the most modern of the bigs in this group. And that is a description that could apply to various degrees to all of them. And that is mostly a positive, but not entirely a positive, because I think the parts of Jaren Jackson's game that he's the least suited for are being de-emphasized, and rebounding is part of what I'm thinking about here, but they're not out of the game entirely. And so I do worry that his weak points being what they are, it might be a little bit of a problem.
Yeah. How much of a believer are you as a GM thinking about selecting Jaren Jackson that scoring points per game just doesn't matter that much? Certainly, we have made great strides in de-emphasizing that aspect of the game as an analytical community. But still, I mean, even when you look at someone like Al Horford, a guy who has been an all-star numerous times in the East, probably wouldn't have been nearly as many times in the West, a guy who was awesome in the playoffs this year, although I thought maybe a little bit over his head from a post-up perspective. But are you a believer that someone who averages 13 points and 8 rebounds, which is kind of like the way you see Jaren Jackson maybe averaging in the traditional statistics, can you believe that that guy is still a really, really valuable player because of the things that don't show up on the stat sheet, because of his ability to space the floor, because of his ability to switch defensively, to intimidate? Now, one thing that he has that Horford doesn't, and we talked about Carter as a comparison for Horford. I actually think that Jackson is a much better comparison for Horford than Carter is his shot blocking, which he was outstanding at 5.7 blocks for 40 minutes, 14.2% block rate, which is even higher than Bamba was, as we talked about in his section. But how much of a believer are you that keeping guys out of the lane, switching ball screen, intimidating at the rim, spacing the floor, making decent decisions, which I think he's actually pretty good at this nascent stage of his development. How much of a believer are you that that's what wins basketball games, and that, we got other guys who score for us, he'll just help them?
And what's so funny about all of that, and I agree with all that, is that Jaren Jackson fills those responsibilities while playing the position that is slowly being marginalized in the league, or not even that slowly anymore. Granted, Jackson could potentially be the type of center that survives, but it'll be a challenge for him, because I think one of the things that I want to talk about early, and this will be a story in a couple of the lower end guys that I've already watched that we're going to talk about, is it's also about contextualizing statistics. And so for me, something that I've just been having trouble wrapping my brain around is that his shot goes in. I mean, so he was 36-93 from three this year, which is 40%, which is very good, of course, and 80% from the line. My biggest concern, though, is with that part of his game, is that his release point is super low, but he's successful enough on it that I don't think he's really going to change his motion. And so some of that might be value lost as a pick and pop guy, though I still think as a trail three player, because he looks so comfortable shooting that weird shot, and it has gone in so far. So it's kind of like reconciling those two things. I think his jump shot might be a little less versatile, a little less valuable, but it is still pretty solid.
Yeah, he does make up for that with his quick release, though, and he doesn't really have much of a dip. He can kind of just shoot it right off of his chest very quickly. And I did think that in terms of being able to shoot on the move a little bit, that he had some versatility to that jump shot. We'll talk a lot more about that momentarily here, but I think, one of the things that we have to be sure about here is, okay, we know what he's supposed to be, right? He's supposed to be this switch guy who can pick and pop to three, block some shots as well. But how good is he really going to be at those things? And then, of course, how much can he supplement those with some of the other stuff that happens? And can he be a good enough scorer to keep defenses honest? First, though, I want to tell you about Quip Toothbrush. Went down to the peninsula, stayed at my fiance's parents last night. And, of course, I had my Quip Toothbrush with me. Takes up absolutely zero space in my dop kit. Basically the same amount of space as a normal toothbrush. It's got this really nifty case that you can put over it, and then you take it off and you can stand it up, even stick it to a mirror or a wall if you need to. And so now I have an electric toothbrush that goes with me and is the size of a normal toothbrush. And hey, you know what? Like, I have a couple of them, but the one that I just keep in my dop kit, it's been sitting there for probably about 3 weeks since the last time I went and stayed overnight somewhere. Oh, well, a regular electric toothbrush battery probably dead. No, not this one. It just uses a normal AAA battery and lasts for as much as 3 months, probably even longer, actually. It lasts for 3 months of being used every day. This one will probably last me even longer than that. And if you've never used an electric toothbrush before, you're really missing out. You've got sweater teeth. That's what my sister would call them, because you can feel the plaque on your teeth. Maybe you don't now, but if you use a Quip, then you'll just be like, oh, wow, my teeth really feel incredibly clean compared to just brushing with a regular manual toothbrush. And it also helps you make sure that you brush for the full 2 minutes, because it's got a timer. It's even got these little blips that let you know it's time to change quadrants in your mouth. It really is just a fantastic piece of equipment. Gotten tons of great comments from people on Twitter who have used the link getquip.com/capspace. That's getquip.com/capspace. Easy to remember. We talk about capspace all the time on the program. That'll get you your first refill pack free. And of course, let them know that you came from us with that /capspace URL. These things start at just $25. It's really an awesome value. Once again, getquip.com/capspace, and you can get on their subscription plan. I know that a lot of people are kind of lazy about changing out their brush head. Well, they'll just send you a new one and a new battery too, actually, every 3 months. And you can switch it out so you're never using a bad brush head again. Once again, getquip.com/capspace is that URL to get your first refill pack free and let them know that you came from us. Let's start as we did with Mo Bamba with his defense. You know, we've been talking a little bit about his offense. I think the defense, though, is the sexier part of him. And that block rate is just astronomical. I mean, he averaged 3 blocks a game, only 22 minutes a game, though, which is maybe one of the more troublesome statistics, which Mike Schmitz hit on a little bit yesterday. Do you believe that he can be just an elite, or maybe can be? I think we both agree he can. Do you believe that he will be an elite defensive player at the NBA level?
I think that he has the tools to be. It takes a lot for me to predict that as being like a likely outcome for anybody, just because it's such a big threshold. One other thing that might prevent him, at least in the early days of being an elite defender, is that part of the reason he played so few minutes is that he fouls a ton.
5.7.
Right, which is crazy high. And some of those are preventable, and some of those are the kind of college fouls where a guy runs into the lane, he's doing the right thing. But I want to take that aside. And what was maybe the most important takeaway for me with Jaren Jackson, which is very different from the other bigs, and I'm not using this to kill the other bigs for it, because certainly they all have their strengths. Defensively, it looks like Jaren Jackson knows what's going on. And like, so for example, there were times where he was in weird positions where he's supposed to be guarding a perimeter player. But when I watched him around on the floor, and I've talked before about how when I watch film on a guy, especially in full game situations, I'm just watching him because I want to see. And that's very important with centers. And every movement he made sense. So if he was coming off of a guy, it was because he saw a driver that he needed to get in the way of. If he was getting closer to somebody, it was based on some sort of other impetus. And that shows that things are working, and he was seeing what was going on the floor, and he was reacting to it. And I really, really like that. And as a young player that can have that part of it there, that's something that all of these other bigs, as talented as Bamba is, as long as his arms are, he's going to need to get better at that, because it wasn't really both a part of his necessary job requirement at Texas, or just because he doesn't have that in his arsenal yet. Guys, it takes a while to learn defense. So I think that was actually the most striking thing, not his shot blocking, but just that it seems like he has a good head on his shoulder.
Remember I remarked on Bamba that I kind of hoped on some of his switch situations, on some of his post-up situations, that given his length, that he would just have these times where he would just swallow guys up and just make them look stupid. Jaren Jackson had that. He had a number of plays where he just made, like, guys would just go up for like some turnaround jumper that they thought they could get off, and he would just swallow them up. His timing as an on-ball shot blocker is outstanding with that 7'5.5" wingspan. You know, not an amazing leaper, but it's just his hands are so quick. Now, part of that is he's going to commit a few more fouls there too by kind of reaching over. I mean, most of his blocks that he's getting happen within an inch or two of it leaving the guy's hand. You know, he's not going up and getting these blocks above the square the way a Bamba would at times. And that's both good and bad, right? I mean, you're probably more likely to commit a foul in that situation, but you're also able to affect guys a little bit more, be more consistent. You don't necessarily have to leave your feet, get up in the air too much. So that's certainly something that I like a little bit. I did not see him get, and now granted, I probably watched maybe three games worth of defensive possessions in addition to a couple of, some of the specific situations like ISOs and post-ups and stuff. I didn't see him get a lot of shot blocks where he was coming over from the weak side, using verticality, really anticipating and getting guys. He's much more effective if he was as a help guy, kind of reacting from behind back to the rim and blocking a guy who didn't realize he was there from behind. And a part of that was because of the role that he was playing. He was playing the four almost exclusively as a defensive player. So very impressive to have the block rate that he did playing the four, but he also had to spend a lot of time out in the perimeter defensively. What do you think about what I said about his shot blocking? Did you see more of those kind of traditional trap the box type of help blocks, or not even blocks, but intimidations at the rim or pre-rotations to stop penetration? Because I didn't see that much of those, but that also could have been a factor that he was guarding, the four man, most of whom even in college can shoot now a lot of the time.
I think some of that was positioning, but also, I mean, like, he had a lot of those kind of like help recovery block type things where the action is actually more like when you get a guy blows past you on a isolation play. I'm not saying that's what happened to Jaren Jackson. It's just that it looked like that, like you're coming from the other side and just kind of catching a guy. As you said, it's a little bit different. And yeah, it's not as much Jaren Jackson about getting into position, but I think intuitively, especially based on how he moved around the floor, that he could get good at that. It's just, it wasn't his job description. And anytime you're trying to think about what a player's role is, you want to see what's directly applicable. And there isn't as much that is directly applicable in this specific case because of what he was asked.
Yeah. Also worth noting that he hasn't turned 19 yet. He is a year younger than Bamba and I think Aiden as well.
I believe he is the youngest guy that is expected to be drafted in this class. I think there's technically someone younger, but it's not somebody who's going to probably.
So that makes him a little bit more projectable to have basically another year of development ahead of him compared to some of these other guys.
Oh, I wanted to mention one other thing. We're talking about defensive kind of positioning and all that. I thought he had the best closeouts and contests of any of these big men by far in terms of consistency, location, keeping his hands up. He could still get better at that. There are times where he kind of closed in with his hands too far down, and that actually led to some of his fouls. But he is the closest to getting that right of any of these guys. And we got to see a lot of film on that because he was guarding fours a lot. So his job responsibilities gave a lot of opportunities to look at it, and I was very impressed with it.
And his feet are just fantastically quick. Now, certainly, as you mentioned, you can have some lapses in concentration, some lapses in technique, but the raw speed that he can display over a short area is really impressive. And not only speed, but then change of direction as well. So guarding guys in pick and pop, he was outstanding getting back to shooters. He should be able to execute any kind of conventional pick and roll coverage, and he might, and then of course he can switch extremely well in isolations against him. And these numbers are a little bit wonky, but opponents scored 12 points on 33 isolation possession against him, and so many of those ended up on just him completely swallowing the guy up. If the guy would get by him, he could block his shot a lot of times from behind, stay in front of guys, get surprise them with a contest, force some really bad misses on jump shots. I mean, this is because, in this day and age, you got to be aware of this. You can switch every ball screen, because that's just sort of that's what everyone wants now. And so you can say that, but how much is it really happening? We express some reservations about Bamba in that area. I don't feel that way about him. I mean, I think for a guy who hopefully is going to be a pure center in the NBA most of the time, that he can stay in front of guys, about as good as it gets. I mean, he's not a Draymond Green level of guy, but I might even put him as having a little bit more raw speed than someone like Capella. Although maybe Capella has just a little bit more in terms of like the length factor and the quick twitch leaping.
So something I noticed watching Jackson's film, which was very interesting, and I noticed this actually watching full games more than though I did see it first for sure in the clip type stuff, but Jaren Jackson got beat by the first move a guy made a little bit more often than I'd be comfortable with if we're talking about a high-end switch guy. But if the first move didn't get him, then that guy wasn't getting past him. And so I generally feel good about that. If I were to pick a flaw, the idea that once he gets settled in, that a guy's just, he's going to keep them in front of him, he's going to make the right decisions. But he is a little bit jumpy. Sometimes the change of pace or something, there were a lot of, and it wasn't just, like a point guard beating him. It could be various different positions. He guarded fours and threes, did it sometimes too. But I liked that kind of once he got into a rhythm. And I think that with Jackson, the mistakes that he makes defensively, which I think were fewer and further between than these other bigs, getting him in the film room, getting him playing against NBA guys in training camp, and then, you know, throughout the season, of course, that he will just get the reps to make those mistakes less frequent.
Yeah, and then just in terms of his ability to be more of a trap the box traditional rim protector, you know, again, we didn't see him go and like play defense with his chest in the air verticality that much, but he's so fast that assuming that he can get the recognition there, which I think, you know, as you said, I think it kind of makes more sense. He was guarding four, so he did have to stick closer to those guys a little bit, but he should be able to just get over there so quickly to really impact guys going to the rim. In the post, you know, again, he would have some of these plays where he would just swallow guys up, especially if guys tried to go to more finesse moves, you know, a fadeaway jumper. When guys could get into his chest, more experienced guys, they were able to get decent shots, like Ethan Happ, who's a really crafty white post player in Wisconsin, surprisingly enough, was able to get some decent looks around the rim against him just by kind of keeping him off balance with little scoop shots and getting into his chest a little bit. But, you know, as young as he is, his frame, 236, you wouldn't want him to get too thick because I think that could impact his speed to some degree, but he definitely has a nice frame. He can get stronger. You know, I think he'll probably settle in around like 245, 250, something like that in his NBA career. And I think he'll get better as a post defender. And as you mentioned, you know, the post up isn't quite as important anymore. Another similarity that he has to Al Horford, though, is not great rebounding statistics. What did you make of that?
The first thing I saw with Jackson, usually I like to do randomized film first and then do a game, but just due to happenstance, I watched the Michigan State Duke game. It was the first thing I saw with Jaren Jackson. That was not a good display of his defensive rebounding because Bagley and Wendell Carter are just so aggressive and so talented as offensive rebounders.
Well, so how is he failing in that game? Because that's not one that I watched a ton of. Was he not boxing out? Was he like just going for the ball and not getting it? Was he not pursuing the ball? Like, where was he inadequate in that game? Because, you know, the Duke was, I think, the best offensive rebounding team in the country this year. Michigan State actually was right up there too. Both of them were over 37%. But how was he failing?
So it was a mix of two different types of failing. So one, there were times where he had inside position but didn't really get the guy. And so in those circumstances, you know, Bagley a couple times, and some of that is also due to Duke having two capable offensive rebounders that it can be a little bit different. But then other times he just wasn't establishing position well enough. And that is a concern, especially because he's an aggressive shot blocker. There are times where he can kind of get in his own way a little bit there where he didn't need to go after it, but I mean, his block rate's ridiculous. So it was a little bit of those two. It was not for me when he was in position and had the seal, he was getting up there. I wasn't worried about that part of it at all.
Yeah, my observations, I didn't watch that one. I didn't really see him have any huge failures. There would be times, again, when he was guarding the four where he might be more concerned about boxing his guy out, coming in, and you know, he would just box out, or even sometimes even face guard his guy and not get turn around and go get the ball. I thought that when he did react to the ball, he was able to cover ground, he was able to get out of his area. 19% defensive rebounds. Now remember, he's playing power forward next to a center, and then on the other end, Michigan State was an awesome offensive rebounding team, but he was only about 8% offensive rebounds, which for this type of a prospect is not very good on the offensive glass at all. I don't expect him, especially the way he's going to be playing probably outside a lot, to be a huge effect on the offensive glass. And, you know, I could see him maybe struggling a little bit on the defensive glass, especially if he's going to be guarding shooters more, if he's got to switch more, if you're in a more of a switching system. You know, I think he could get better at really crashing the glass when a shot goes up, when he's guarding a guy who's not a great defensive rebound or a great offensive rebounding threat. But, you know, it's not like the team overall was a bad, I think they're 40th in the nation in defense rebounding.
Yeah, the context is very, very important there. Before we move on to something else, it was in the post-up section, but I didn't make the note out loud. But Jaren Jackson has a problem that every single big in this class, and I think it might just be the way that guys grow, is just some of his fouls come from not trusting his size. Where, like, there was a play I watched the Michigan game, which I was fascinated in, the game at Michigan State, and having him largely, well, he was sometimes often matched up with Mo Wagner, who's in his own unusual type of prospect. And there were a few plays where Jackson was in position, but just kind of got a little antsy and went for a reach or didn't put his hands all the way up. And just ironing out that It's kind of like the low closeout thing. Like, I think that he has the tools to do that. And again, that would tie in with the foul rate. If he can just kind of take out the unnecessary, let's call it a third of his fouls, and then maybe reduce the need for some of the next third, then maybe that won't be as big of an issue at the next.
And they had a lot of depth for bigs. Tom Izzo wants his guys to play hard. He'd pick up a lot of like loose ball fouls and stuff, which, you know, hopefully he'll be able to edit out of his game a little bit. Let's turn now to the offense and that jump shot. Give you some stats on that. Well, just some overall offensive stats. 23.5% usage. That's relatively low for a prospect that's being talked about in the top five. Only 11 points a game, 6 rebounds, 3 blocks. Did have 2 assists per 40 minutes, however, and had that 39.6% for 3, 80% from the foul line. Turned it over on 17% of his possessions. Again, some of those could be offensive fouls, loose ball foul type of plays. Also, you know, showed some inexperience in terms of some of the turnovers that he would have. He would have some head scratchers on occasion. But I did like his ability in the DHO game. I thought that he generally was just able to make the pass that was in front of him quickly. He moved the ball relatively quickly when the pass was there. I thought as a high-low passer, he showed some promise. He was able to get guys going backdoor a little bit. And they ran a lot of stuff for him where he would either pick and pop to three or do a DHO and then pop to three. Or he could set a wide pin down for a guy coming out of the corner and then pop to three after that. And I thought that his footwork looked pretty good on those shots. Even if he wasn't perfectly set, he's able to get it off quickly. And especially when he was able to take a little bit more time and really be open, he shot the ball very well. 12 out of 29 on unguarded catch and shoot jumpers. Basically every single jumper he took was a three. And then even on guarded catch and shoot, still 54% field goal percentage. That's totally solid.
Yeah, I definitely thought that jump shooting was the best part of his offensive game. And part of that is because, I would say overall that is. But he has some of this stuff. I've talked before at length about how I want to see bigs basically trained as if they're smalls, just to get into the comfort of jump shooting and a lot of that kind of stuff. But Jaren Jackson wants the ball in his hands way too much, like as a dribbler, and he isn't good at it. And I assume that the NBA will just take all of that out because there's no place for it. But it concerns me not so much that his skill level is low, but that he has enthusiasm for it, because that's really where you can start to get into trouble. And there were a couple times where you're just kind of sitting there and he's like trying to drive into the paint and you're going, what are you trying to do? And I think that also connects with what to me is in some ways the more concerning problem, which is that he plays on the interior offensively, not defensively, but offensively. He plays too much like a finesse guy. He's big and not ripped or anything like that, but he doesn't play with the same kind of force that he does as a shot blocker, when just like, hey, I can go through this guy for a dunk, or, you know, like he's way too comfortable going with the kind of the finesse, the go around the guy instead of going through him or making the pass or something else.
Yeah, and he did have a very low free throw rate, only 3 free throw attempts basically per game, which is not great, again, for the type of player this is. He spent a lot of time in the perimeter, which is worth talking about. I want to react to what you said about attacking off the dribble. I understand why you put it the way that you did. You sounded like you're pretty down on it and that he shouldn't do that. I actually believe there's some hope for that part of his game. I think he's got some pretty good quickness. He's smooth. He actually was able to make some decent passes on the move, and guys are going to be really closing out hard to him. Now, as a off those closeouts, anytime he puts the ball on the floor, he's going left. He's going left every single time. He's much more comfortable finishing with his left hand. He did develop a little bit of a counter to where he could go left and then spin back right. Although his righty jump hook, he's not as comfortable with that. He kind of shoots that righty jump hook without nearly as much extension. He kind of pushes it a little bit, almost similar to the way he pushes his jump shot. You know, people have speculated that maybe he's more of a left-handed guy that just shoots his jumper right-handed, but a jumper goes in. You can't complain about that too much. But yeah, the fact that he goes left all the time is not great. But I actually saw him throw some nice big-to-big passes, off a dribble or two. And I think he's quick enough that it doesn't like take him forever to get all the way to the rim, because he's fast enough. So I think he could refine that if he can actually go both directions. It's also similar to Al Horford. Again, Al Horford has to go right every single time off of a closeout. Jackson goes left every single time. So I think he's got some hope with that aspect of his game. And I think it could work out, or, you know, the fake DHO and then take a couple dribbles to the rim, that type of play. I think that that is something that I expect to be part of his game eventually.
Oh, yeah, I'm totally I'm on board with the idea that he can get there. As he just needs to change the mentality. And I would rather have the building blocks and have to change the approach than the other way around, because that's a lot. It's a lot easier to fix. And it's just going to take some time. And I fully assume that it will happen, but it will take some time. And I'm happy you brought up the passing, because that was the other thing I wanted to talk about, is that he had a couple of different types of passes that I enjoyed. Michigan State, due to often playing two big guys, there were times where, as he was on the three-point line and threw some good interior passes too. I think Ward was usually the guy who was kind of posting up, and Ward I liked better as a post-up player than Jaren Jackson, which is fine. And then also, when he had the ball on the inside, he wasn't as good as Wendell Carter, who I think was is the standout in this class of just keeping his head up and trying to find the open guy. But Jackson did a nice job of when the circumstances are like, hey, you should pass here, that he was able to make a good decision. There were a couple times where he got it to the opposite corner for threes, a couple of times where he got it just to an open player. And it's great if they can be at that higher level, if they can make that extra pass. But I'm happy with where Jackson is as a passer overall, especially at his age.
Yeah, in the post, he didn't get the ball a lot. You know, I thought he did a reasonable job of trying to get decent position. One thing that people said is that he's a little bit soft. I think, you know, maybe on the glass, that's true to some degree. The aggressiveness of his finishes, although again, like that lefty hook that he gets great extension on, it is a good shot for him. But yeah, like the power, get your shoulder into the guy, go up strong type of plays. You know, he'll go up for like a two-handed dunk, but he's not really going to dunk on people. 65 points on 53 possessions. The post, 53 possessions is a pretty low number. That's very efficient, of course, but you know, they weren't really looking for him in the post that much. As you mentioned, their other big, Ward, didn't have any kind of range, so he would have to post up more. Jackson did have some range, so he would be outside a little bit more. His face-up game out of the post is a little problematic because the release on his jump shot is so low. I would actually feel better about his potential as a one-on-one scorer because he is pretty quick. If he could actually just get his release a little bit higher so he could shoot over guys when he turns and faces and then use a jab step and blow by them, you know, I might like his offense a little bit more, but I don't know that type of a change in his jumper is going to be forthcoming. So it's just hard for him to turn and face and get that shot off. As I mentioned, not as comfortable going left shoulder on the block. He's capable there. You know, he's not just like, he's not totally Zoolander Sabonis-ing it, but, you know, he definitely wants to get back to his right shoulder most of the time. Also, no real turnaround jumper game at all. You know, it's got to be a hook shot if it's a guy between him and the basket. So, I think he could maybe be okay against switches at times, but I don't expect him to be a guy who's just going to, even smaller players, like just wear them out in the post necessarily. Maybe, again, he's pretty young. Maybe he can get there. You know, he's got good touch and a good skill level. For his finishing, wasn't really used at all as a roll man in pick and roll, of course, because nobody is apparently in college. They just don't have the spacing. They don't have the passing, you know, unless Trae Young is your point guard. He's not, you know, a ridiculous alley-oop type of finisher, but, you know, I think if you throw it up towards the rim pretty close to there, he can go up and get it. You know, he's not like incapable of going to get that, but, you know, he's not going to be a guy who's going to catch it at the corner of the backboard and throw it down for you or go up, you know, to the top of the square and get it and finish from all angles. Like, he's kind of got to be open. You know, he's not going to get those Capella, DeAndre Jordan type of big time dunk.
Yeah. I thought his catch radius though was pretty solid. It wasn't otherworldly like some of these guys.
Hands.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that he can benefit from some of that. And Michigan State's guards were not nearly as infuriating as Texas's, but there were times where I thought they could, that he would have more opportunities in the NBA also just with the change in spacing and everything.
Yeah, I mean, I would love to know. I saw it for maybe like 2 minutes in the games that I watched of Bridges at the four and Jackson at the five. They almost like never went to that line. I don't know what the state was of like all their other guards and forwards. Good idea. And obviously they're a very successful team, you know, until they had to play that Syracuse zone and decided that the best way to attack that was just passing it back and forth from guard to guard up top for 25 seconds and jacking three. It's still amazing that like no one has come up with better zone offense against the two, but that's a topic for another day. Anything else you want to talk about for him?
Yes. So at the end of that game against Michigan, which Michigan State ended up losing, when they were kind of scrambling to come back, I think they were down six at that point, Izzo's desired play call was one of their guards, I can't remember which one of them for the life of me, was setting a screen off ball for Jaren Jackson to shoot a three. And I'm just sitting there going, wow, like that is a level of trust for that coach and that player to, in a key situation, to say, okay, what we want is we want Jaren Jackson Jr., who is a center, who will be a center in the NBA, to take a three. And I think he missed it, but it was a clean look. It was a good play call. And I was just shocked because you don't see that in college really ever.
And one of the reasons that I'm more of a believer in his shooting is that he was really treated like he was a good shooter by his coach, right? I mean, I talked about some of the stuff that they would run for them, and then they say, hey, pop to three and take it. You know, like those are the shots that they wanted him shooting. And, you know, he's only 96 attempts or whatever it was. It is not a huge number, but when you throw in the free throw shooting, his age, how comfortable he looked shooting from out there. I mean, he even shot, like, it was a desperation play, but he even had like a step back three at one point going to his left, the speed of his release. And then just, you know, I mean, clearly they believed in what he was capable of doing, seeing it in practice all year, that they ran their offense and it had all these plays in where he was popping for a three-pointer. And, you know, he wasn't getting taken out of the game for these shots or anything. So it was clearly there was a belief from his coaching staff, who's very familiar with him, that he could shoot the ball even, you know, at this point in time. And I also don't think, given kind of the way his release is, he's not really reliant on, you know, getting a ton of rise on his shot. And so that means I think he's going to be able to transition out to NBA distance, you know, a little easier than some other guys. Well, so let me ask you this question. Let's say he fails. How does that happen?
The jump shot doesn't provide as much value, either because it doesn't go in as much or because it being so low and he can't really move it up that it gets blocked and just doesn't have as much there. Defensively, either he can't get over the foul issue or the lack of bulk makes him exploitable by the best of the best, and that's enough to make it uncomfortable. But yeah, I think his straight up bust rate is lower. And so a question I want to ask you on a similar note is, so I deliberately didn't read it. I actually don't know when it came out until after I finished Jaren Jackson. But there was an interesting piece that the ESPN analytics, like their model, came out with. And one of the points that it made was that Jaren Jackson had a high success rate. I can't remember exactly what the term was, but that he had a low, like, superstar / all-star, you know, like that really rarefied air. And I thought that was an interesting kind of way of describing him. And I think of that as a largely a positive thing. And I also think that's pretty accurate.
I do, because I would be very surprised if he ever scores more than 16 or 17 points a game in the NBA. You know, I mean, it's really, I don't know how, I mean, unless he just becomes like an absolutely dominating pick and pop shooter and his post game just gets way, way better and he's able to develop a face up jump shot and really be a go-to guy in the post, which I'm not precluding, but seems unlikely with guys of his ilk. He is younger though, so there's a, and I think, you know, he is agile. You know, I think he's able to get on balance. He's got quickness. He's smooth, has a pretty good skill level for his age. So I'm not precluding that, but I think it's pretty unlikely, especially just because teams don't want to go into the post anymore necessarily. Yeah. And so, I mean, when we're talking about him being comparable to Al Horford, that means, like, you know, that's his best outcome is Al Horford. And Al Horford was, but I mean, let's remember, Al Horford was drafted number three. Nobody was going to say that was a bad pick at number three to get Al Horford. You know, granted, Al has had some times where he's had detractors and they felt like, you know, he couldn't carry a team in the playoffs and et cetera, et cetera. But I mean, if you get a guy who can be as good as Al Horford at that pick, you're feeling great about it. I mean, just getting anybody who makes even like a few all-star teams, is even as high as, or I should say as low as the number three pick, you still feel pretty good about that pick. Like, you have to remember, you know, I think this is going to be a very good draft. I've been really impressed by so many of these guys when you compare it to how we might have felt about some of these previous drafts going in. So, but still, I mean, I think his like 90th percentile, you know, 95th percentile outcome is Al Horford. I'd be shocked if he could find a way to be better than him. But then, you know, there's a lot of room.
And it's worth mentioning that. And it's also worth mentioning that I think Al Horford reached pretty high on his outcomes as well. I mean, Horford has been a wonderful player. So, you know, you're kind of, I think that it's an interesting parallel with those two guys. And Horford went third, and that was the Odin Durant draft. So he went above not only his college teammate, Joakim Noah, but Mike Conley had a real star turn that one year at Ohio State. And then there were just a bunch of other guys that were intriguing that year. And Horford was the third pick, and that was correct. So do you want to talk at all about where he fits in with the centers? Because I feel pretty confident in part of that and not confident.
Well,
in
I mean, I think we can save, especially once we do, we're going to try and do some more of the guys who are, you know, late lottery, mid first round to talk about. I think we should just do an episode where we reveal our entire big board before the draft. So maybe we can save that.
We can do that.
And I want to think about that more. I mean, I obviously have some ideas, but let's do a read here and then we can get into the off season for the Orlando Magic. And if you want to see all of these rookies next season, preseason, whenever, SeatGeek is the way to go. Not only for sports, but also concerts, comedy, theater, anything that's got a ticket, SeatGeek is the smartest, easiest way to get tickets. Two reasons for that. Saves you time, saves you money. Saves you time by aggregating ticket sites together. So now you don't have to go to a bunch of different sites. You can just go to the SeatGeek app, and then saves you money by ranking every ticket based on value. And actually also saves you time by doing that as well. Because now you look at the section where you want to sit, you look for that big, dark green dot that just, you see that and it just starts to release endorphins at this point. And you know you're going to get a great value there. You have to worry that there might be a ticket that's, is $10 cheaper? Is that worth sitting another section away from center court or not? With those rankings, which are a great algorithm, I've been very impressed by it, you can just find the best value ticket in the general area and hey, you're done in 90 seconds. You just bought your tickets. This used to take you like 20, 25 minutes. And for someone like me who's super analytical, I was always stressing out that I wasn't finding the best deal. That stress is now gone. So the way to get started with them is that with that SeatGeek app on your phone, if you are a first-time SeatGeek purchaser, you can get $20 off by entering promo code CAPSPACE today. Easy to remember. We talk about CAPSPACE all the time in the program. Once again, promo code CAPSPACE for $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. Now let's talk about the offseason for the Orlando Magic, possessing the number 6 overall pick in the draft for the 97th consecutive year. Really kind of seems like that. They've been drafting in that range forever. I guess they had number 2 in 2013. That player is now a superstar and they don't have him anymore. But it is a new regime now in Orlando. Jeff Weltman, John Hammond, they took over late last year, didn't have a chance to do that much other than just draft Jonathan Isaac with, you guessed it, the number 6 overall pick in the draft. Rather than talk about their cap situation, I think we should start with just talking about where this team is right now after this will be their 6th summer of rebuilding since the Dwight Howard trade.
And that challenge gets compounded by the questions about what is the core of this team, because Jonathan Isaac, who we both really liked in the draft, had largely a lost season due to injury. I have, there wasn't anything really concerning that I saw in that circumstance, but it is, it is what it is. And then a lot of the other pieces are a little bit older, like Evan Fournier, Bismack Biyombo. They're not old, but they're older. And you don't really know if they're part of the future. So I would say kind of where they are right now is that they are a little bit too good to be the worst, but not good enough to really be a serious playoff, unless Steve Clifford does unlock something that Frank Vogel could not.
Yeah, and so really they have, with Vucevic going to be a free agent after next year and not really, to my eyes, an adequate starting center defensively. Biyombo never able to duplicate what he did in Toronto with his contract, so they need a center. Now those, fortunately, are easier to come by. Power forward of the future, probably taken care of. Even if Aaron Gordon does not re-sign as a restricted free agent, we'll talk about his situation, of course. But you've got John Isaac there. He's really pretty much a typical modern power forward in today's game. Whether you could play Gordon and Isaac together is a tough question. I mean, Isaac did not shoot the ball well last year. Maybe he can get to the point, but he really seems like more of a shooter from the four position than like the really good shooter you need as a three.
Well, I think if you play those guys together, it's as the four and the five, not as the four and the three.
Yeah, and Isaac does have that 9-1 standing reach to where maybe he can play center, but also very thin. You're going to have some rebounding problems there. You know, I don't think you can use that as an every down lineup, at least at this point in time for these guys' careers. Maybe Gordon becomes a better shooter, Isaac becomes a better shooter. You can play them together on the wing. Or your other option, too, is maybe you get a really good shooting center, but having someone who can do that and also defend, and then you could have Isaac and Gordon at the 3 and 4. And that could be a pretty good defensive lineup, potentially. And then Fournier, I think he's probably an adequate starting shooting guard, but not someone that I'm like, I'm incredibly excited about. They got him for 3 more years, potentially, as that player option for $17 million in the 2020-21 season. Man, that's going to be really annoying to say constantly. And then they have absolutely nothing at point guard. So their biggest holes right now are probably point guard and center, but with the lack of offensive talent on this team at the moment, I think you're really in best player available mode. You know, maybe unless it's a power forward, you know, you'd wonder about. I mean, really the only guy who's going to be on the board in their range draft-wise that you'd say, hey, you know, I don't know if I necessarily want to take him because the guys we already have might be Michael Porter. Although still, I think if you believe that Porter is a future offensive superstar, you'd take him anyway.
Oh, I was thinking about Bagley, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but it sounds like Bagley's going to be gone amazingly at that point. But yes, yeah.
Yeah, we'll see.
I mean, if you wanted to play Bagley at center, I mean, maybe. But yeah, I agree. He's not a great fit. And I like Isaac probably better than Bagley, to be honest.
I do too. Well, so something else that's interesting with the Magic, I've said this idea for a while now, and it's still true for a little bit, is that they have a lot of guys who would benefit from having somebody above them in the totem pole. So I think the perimeter rotation is a good example of this. Like, Terrence Ross can be a part of a successful rotation. Jonathan Simmons, same thing. Fournier, but you need that player above them. And so that's kind of the idea of swinging high in the draft, is that maybe it could balance out the rotation a little bit longer. And they have a backup point guard in Augustine, though we have to be concerned because this is the opposite year, you know, like the every other year thing. So maybe he's not going to be as strong this year, and then he'll have a better year when he's expiring.
He's like a baseball team.
Yeah. And so they do need a point guard. And I think that's going to be the big clarifying thing that I've been wondering about with the Magic, because they don't have a ton of cap space. So they can't really overhaul, and they don't really have as many positive contracts. But a lot is going to be told on what asset they use to get a point guard. You know, if it's the mid-level exception, then okay, you know, they could do something with that depending on if they go for a vet or a young guy. If it's their draft pick, then they're looking a little bit more towards the future, because rookie point guards are almost never good, especially when they're really, really young. So,
oh yes, young.
I'm excited. I wasn't trying to make a pun, but it kind of works. Because Trae Young, it's probably going to take him a while. I mean, as much as you and I both like him, and he's a better passer than some guys are his age, I just the NBA speed and
I have a feeling, I really like Young, I have a feeling he's going to look awful his first year. I mean, we've seen just where if he's trying to do some of this crazy stuff that he did in college, like, I mean, he's going to have to tighten up his game to some degree. And I think that's going to be a very painful learning process, even though I am very high on.
It would be pretty funny for Steve Clifford to go from Malik Monk, who didn't have the urgency to play, to if they draft Trae Young. Like, oh, yay, congratulations, you got a more fun circumstance. But I mean, I'm still excited. That's the other big question I have for the Magic, is just what parts of what we saw with Clifford as the head coach in Charlotte are mandatory for him. So those teams they all played traditional centers pretty reliably. They all were really low turnover teams, though that did dissipate a little bit from what I recall towards the end of his tenure in Charlotte. But the personnel in Orlando is dramatically different than what it was in Charlotte. And so I'm wondering whether he's going to be so wedded to traditional centers, not so much for this year because they have Vooch and Biombo on roster, but moving forward.
Yeah, and right now in the draft, I mean, I think this is one, especially since we've done all of our analysis for the guys in this range now, that I think we should really have a good discussion about who they should take, because I think there's going to be players, there are going to be players available to them. ESPN's mock right now has them taking Wendell Carter. Again, I am not low on Carter by any means. He fits into that traditional Steve Clifford center that you're talking about. But man, I have very little interest in taking a guy without superstar upside, because that's just what this Magic team so desperately needs. I mean, to me, if Trae Young is on the board, that's the pick for me if I'm the Orlando Magic. Now, and it seems like the chances that he would be gone as of that time are quite low. And I mean, I think I would go with him. They just so desperately need someone who can really create on the perimeter, and not even just from a need standpoint. It's just in general, I think those are the more valuable players. I would not be, I mean, I guess the only way that one of the centers other than Carter falls to them is if Michael Porter goes above them. So it really seems like their decision will be between Trae Young, Mike Porter, and Wendell Carter. Most likely, if that is the decision that they have to make, who are you taking?
I would take Trae Young for them. But I think Porter would actually be an interesting bet, on the logic that I don't think Aaron Gordon is necessarily set. And actually, those two guys as a forward combination are intriguing. So basically what you're betting on is that all three of those guys aren't going to work out, meaning Gordon, Isaac, and Porter. And if they all work out, then you have a good problem and you can trade one of them, or you can play Isaac at center, whatever you're going to do. So I would, and there's a big caveat here in terms of what's going on with Michael Porter's back, and they will presumably have better information than I do right now.
And Schmitz, actually, so yesterday, since we're recording this Monday morning, you probably haven't had a chance to listen to that, but he was saying that maybe even some teams are thinking of Porter as kind of, he's going to almost get a redshirt year, you know, maybe not Harry Giles type, but just that he's going to really need some time to get back into it.
Yeah, and if that's what it takes, and you don't have as many long term worries, then I'm okay with that for a lot of different teams. Just like the Magic, I said, I don't think they're a playoff team, but that generally kind of back injuries scare me for the exact reason that you never know when it's going to pop in, and you have to be super cautious with them. So yeah, my instinct right now would be Trae Young, Porter, then Wendell Carter, because I think that fits in with what they need. And another kind of challenge here for Orlando, they could have some cap flexibility moving forward. It depends a lot on how they use their stuff. But if they don't get a point guard of the future now, if they, you know, because I don't think they're going to just be awful next year, it's going to be hard to get that guy moving forward. You know, the point guards, once they hit free agency, are almost always expensive, or they're really risky, you know, like Dante Exum kind of situation. So if they don't get that guy now, and I'm not saying take the wrong guy, but if the right guy is available with Trae Young, don't overthink this.
Yeah, and for some reason they weren't interested in Young, I'd probably still go with Porter over Carter. It's very difficult for me to imagine a situation in which Wendell Carter is changing your destiny as a franchise, and this team desperately needs a change of its destiny. And I think, you know, it's rare to me that drafting at number six, you would actually have two guys with the upside of Young and Porter available, guys who could be really number one offensive option if things break right for them. And that, as we mentioned, is what this team desperately needs. Now, if they were to take Porter, the whole thing with Aaron Gordon becomes a lot more interesting. Porter shooting, you know, is one of his better qualities. I think that he and Isaac might be better suited to play together, or he and Gordon might be better suited to play together than Gordon and Isaac together because of Porter's shooting ability and his scoring. But, you know, playing all three of those guys together, you know, that would be a huge front court. You know, you would basically have everyone at like Gordon, I think, is 6'9", but he's got a lot of athleticism. A huge front court in the aggregate, but you don't really have that one center. I mean, that would be a really interesting positionless type of approach if you wanted to play all those guys together. I would love to see that tried. I don't know if they would have the balls to do that necessarily. And as we mentioned, Aaron Gordon is, of course, a restricted free agent. So perhaps we should discuss his situation now and their overall cap situation as well, how he fits into that.
Yeah, so I'll start with their overall cap situation. And for the Magic, if they keep Aaron Gordon's hold on the books, which is certainly the assumption we want to use, at least for the start of the offseason, they're over the cap, but have a lot of running room between there and the tax line. Granted, maybe they don't want to go all the way to the tax line, but they have a lot of flexibility. So theoretically, they could re-sign Gordon if they wanted to, re-sign Mario Hezonja, use the full mid-level, use the biannual if they wanted to, use the trade exception. They have a $3.3 million trade exception. I think they would be able to use all of those things unless Aaron Gordon gets like maxed or damn close to it. But the other thing to keep in your background is before any money for Aaron Gordon, Orlando could have about $46 million in cap space for 2019. So if they want to spend aggressively this year and go after multi-year contracts, that is going to take away the ability to spend money next year. And that $46 million does not include the potential of stretching Bismack Biyombo, where they could add another $11 million going that route. I'm not saying they should do that. I'm not saying they will do that, but they could. So they could get up into like the high 50s next year without Aaron Gordon. So that means they could get into the 40s.
Yeah, and if they wanted to dump DJ Augustin, they could do that as well. 48 would have 2 years left at that point. I think, to me, the Gordon situation is kind of its own thing because he's so young. You know, what offer it would take for me to not match would be an interesting one. But I think the greater question that they have to answer, and you started to hit on this with this, the idea of how rough Trae Young's rookie season might be, is what is this team going to try and do right now? I mean, we mentioned this, they're approaching like Phoenix levels and not quite Sacramento levels yet of just non-contention for the playoffs. And the reality is that they're almost no closer to the playoffs than they were when they moved on from Dwight Howard 6 years ago. And so what is, you know, Rich DeVos, their owner, is older? Is he going to be impatient? Did Clifford, did he come in here to oversee a rebuilding project, or is the idea to get them back to respectability as fast as possible? And to me, despite the fact, I mean, they have definitely tried to shortcut this before, right? I mean, you think of all the terrible moves that they've made since then, you know, the Tobias Harris trade and, oh, we're going to get $50 million in cap space. Oh, wait, but it's the summer of 2016. Don't. And the Serge Ibaka trade and getting rid of Oladipo, getting rid of Sabonis. Like, they've tried the shortcuts before. I think the shortcuts may be a little easier just because there are fewer teams kind of trying to compete now. But, and when I say shortcuts, that's, you know, getting to the eighth seed. I mean, this is a team that's gone hard for the eighth seed. It couldn't even get the eighth seed. You know, I mean, that's one of those things where, like, when you try to compete, sometimes even getting to, like, that piddling level of success doesn't even work. But I still think they need to be treating this as, like, hey, this is year one. And hopefully, maybe year two. And hopefully that is the mandate that Weltman and Hammond came in with to build up slowly, you know, to say, hey, even in 2019, there's going to be a lot of teams with 2019 cap space. Maybe it's a good idea to zig at that point. Maybe it's a good idea to, you know, trade a Biombo or an Augustine or take on some even worse money, or same thing with Fournier or Simmons. I mean, those are kind of the big, even Augustine, because he's a useful player. Those are the guys that you could look at as, like, between Simmons, Ross too is in that, he's an expiring contract, where they have guys who are just going to push them towards, you know, 35 wins maybe if they're lucky, but who can play, who could be vehicles for taking on bad salary through the summer of 2020. And then maybe you target the summer of 2020 as your time to try to get better, though that'll be another big cap space year, most likely. But I think that's got to be the approach. And we've advocated this for a number of teams, but there are so many teams trying to dump salary and also get better that I think it could work. So Fournier, Vucevic is another guy too. You know, I mean, they've got, as you mentioned, all these useful players. I think those guys need to be used to try and get more assets and just recognize where they are in the process. I just have this feeling that that's not the direction they're going
to
go, though.
I agree with you. I'm reluctant to say that they will align with that. Another guy to mention, you mentioned Vuce, but Terrence Ross. I mean, Terrence Ross could be a part of the team's rotation.
Yeah. Oh, you did. I mean, those are a lot of guys who are not...
But yeah, I mean, it's just a million guys.
Right. I mean, maybe you could look at Fournier as the one of those guys that's like a real bonafide starter, and there are teams that could use his skill set as a guy who could run a second side pick and roll.
And his third season might make that a little bit harder, but there's enough bad money that I'm sure there's a team that would see the overall net there as being strongly in their favor. You know, there are ways of making that work. And I think this ties in with what I think is going to be fascinating with the Magic in terms of figuring out where the front office thinks they are. I mean, the draft pick will be a part of it, but also what they do with the mid-level exception. Orlando is one of the few teams that, as presently, you know, our current understandings, could use the full non-taxpayer MLE because they're over the cap but under the tax. And so that's about $8.6 million based on the current estimates that are out there. I think it's going to be pretty close to that. And $8.6 million will go a lot further this year than it would have in a lot of previous ones. But how far is still an open question. I mean, so they can, if they want to win now, maybe they could make an aggressive bid for Wayne Ellington or Mbah Moute, or maybe even Derek Favors. Not that I think that's a particularly great fit considering all the centers they have. But then they could go, you know, they go with a point guard. Fred VanVleet offer sheet would be interesting for them. Exum. A lot of different pathways for the Magic to go through, or, you know, Bielitsa. There are a lot of different things.
Yeah, VanVleet, that's an interesting one, especially considering that Weltman was in Toronto until recently. VanVleet obviously was a bit player during his time there, but that could be one. And then VanVleet has shown the ability to play next to another point guard, both defensively and spacing the floor. So, you know, he could play some backup point guard. He could play some if you do draft Trae Young. You know, that wouldn't preclude VanVleet. And I like the idea of using that MLE to try to get a guy on a contract that, even if it's not necessarily going to be a value contract, but you mentioned that's going to be a powerful tool this year since there are so few teams that can use that. And so the fact that they wouldn't have to use cap space necessarily to take on money, that they could send out a useful player instead with some of their expiring contracts or with a guy you can play with two more years on it, you're staying over the cap then, and then you can use that full MLE to try to get another piece that could still be an asset. It maybe help you be a little bit more respectable this season. So I like that idea, the idea of VanVleet, you know, or you could even try to go, I mean, I do think you want to get someone who's young enough where that can be a value contract where they could maybe grow and exceed it. Van Vliet maybe falls into that category. Or maybe you could even split up that full MLE, give out a couple of, you know, $4 million contracts to guys who are, you know, in that Travion Graham type of range. Maybe that's a little much for him. But, you know, to try to get younger guys of that ilk on contracts that might seem, you know, they're like, oh, $4 million guaranteed for a few years. Yeah, I'll take that. But then they actually have the potential to outgrow it. And if it doesn't work out, it's not such a huge contract that it's going to be a major problem. Should we get back to Gordon now and talk about his restricted free agency?
Yeah, let's do it. So Gordon will turn 23 before the start of next year. And as you said, that is, especially with the age limit where it is right now, that is very young for restricted free agency, for any free agency, really. And Gordon, I mean, my general read on him, it's been hard to calibrate, especially with the weird season where he ended up playing a lot of three because they traded for Serge Ibaka for no damn good reason other than Rob Hennigan trying to save his job. And so my current read on Gordon is that I like him better as a small cog in a big machine, you know, that if he doesn't have to be a primary offensive option, and then maybe he could work as a switch defender, 2-3-4, something in that range. I think that would be a lot better for him. The problem is there's big winner's curse stuff with players like that, players who aren't clearly max caliber. Like Otto Porter, I think, is a great example. It's like Otto Porter, small cog, big machine. But because he plays a position of value, Porter more so than Gordon, he got paid a lot of money. And so the idea that you talked about of him getting an offer and then just thinking about agonizing about whether to max it, I think that's exactly where this is going.
All right. So now it's my time to ask you. This is always such a tough question of what is, I mean, we can do this in two parts. Number one, what is your offer to keep him out of restricted free agency on July 1 that you think he might actually take, by the way? And then number two, what is the highest offer that you wouldn't match? Or I'm sorry, the lowest offer, I guess.
So I think I would be looking at a starting offer because there is some risk here because there aren't that many slots. And it's not clear necessarily that Gordon is the priority everywhere. I mean, whether that is something like Capella and Jokic, and think another team could just pivot to Gordon after those guys get matched. And, you know, some teams might be more interested in Jabari than Aaron Gordon. Gordon has certainly shown more in his time, but Jabari was high ceiling guy, was drafted above Aaron Gordon for a reason. So I would probably offer him something around $18 million a year, as that would be the average value. So starting salary. Actually, I would consider front loading it just to, but he wouldn't care about that. You offer the years and dollars and figure out the structure after. And I don't think he would accept that, but I think there is a chance that it's in the range he ends up getting. And the highest offer, whew, so.
All right, well let's, here, this is easy. The max, would you let's say it's a three
so
plus one.
So it would be a three plus one
for the max. So that's 4 years, $108.6 million. He'd be making $29 million in the 2021-22 season.
God, that's rich for me. My big concern there, I don't think I would, because I don't see a superstar just like laying dormant in him. I see the potential for a very good player, you know, like the second or third guy on a very successful team. And so even though $27 million, $28 million isn't, you know, that needs to lose some of its stigma because the salary cap is rising. Hell, if it goes to 108 next year, then that will change a lot. But I don't think, my instinct is that losing Aaron Gordon is not going to haunt you. And so for me, when that's the line, if that's how I feel about him, then I probably shouldn't be paying that guy even a quarter of the salary cap.
Yeah, you know, I think maybe my offer to him to start would be somewhere around like $19 million a year for 5 years. I think I would actually want to lock in that fifth year if I could for him, because he's so young, really get him in through his prime. And it's just, he does have a lot of upside. It's just the shooting, still don't believe it's really ended up around 34% last year after that incredible scorching start that we knew could never sustain. But and as much as that dropped down, I mean, that's pretty incredible. He's got a lot of athleticism. Can he, I mean, I guess, how about this? What would he have to evolve into to be worth that max contract?
Well, he doesn't have to be a number one option. Right. That would be unfair. But I would say a secondary scoring option who is a capable, versatile defensive player.
I mean, he's probably got to be basically, you know, maybe not Sean Marion, because Sean Marion is still an underrated player, but, you know, close to that type of player. Guard 1-5 and do it, you know, at an above average level at every position. He has not reached that yet, obviously, but he's still only 20. I mean, he was so young when he was drafted. And What are the chances that he reaches that? I mean, I think, Marion, Gordon would probably be a better shooter than Marion. Marion, just, one of the all-time greatest players ever in transition. Gordon can get close to that level, actually. I mean, he's got that type of bounce. He's not that type of a quick jumper. I don't think he has that type of intensity that Marion had. But I mean, that's who we really have been talking about here. I mean, maybe he's not going to be a top 15 player, but he's got to be a real poor man, Sean Marion. The chances that he could get there, do I want to say 30%, 40%, something like that? You're kind of taking the risk by signing him.
What's concerning to me is also the chances that he becomes a lot more than that. If we're talking about the ceiling play here with Aaron Gordon, to me, isn't crazy. It's not like there's that. That's what I was talking about. I don't think there's a superstar Drummond in him. So that's because that's the other way you can get value is by a guy just dramatically exceeding what we think he, could be. Maybe he could do an Oladipo style elevation, but I don't think he's capable enough with the ball in his hands. It would require his jump shot getting more consistent and just having him clean up some of the stuff. I talked about this on a 15 and 60 back in the day. I was wondering why Gordon was so inefficient comparatively in transition. It was because he was shooting way too many threes. So cleaning up some of that. But yeah, I mean, I just think that that's a big concern for me. And that's also a big difference with Jabari. I think the best case scenario is a lot better than it is for Aaron Gordon, even if the expected value is much closer, if not in Gordon's favor.
Yeah, I'm in agreement there. So maybe if it's the max... Oof, that's so. And this is one of those ones where I think if you're Orlando, you want to be relatively aggressive with an offer that is less than the max. And maybe the way to do that is, you can front load it. You start him at 22 million and then you do declines as well to make it easier potentially to move. You do start him at 22 million, do the maximum possible decline. So it ends up being, a 5-year, $100 million. Maybe that's about what I'd be looking at. Once you get above 20 million for him, then it starts to get rough, right? Because you want these contracts for a guy that young to have some upside. And I'm just, if you're paying him for, and then maybe, a sign and trade could be something that you would look at there also, if there's a team that really likes him. See, the other part though, for the restricted free agency is, I'm not sure who that team really is. That's just so obviously an Aaron Gordon suitor. But as you mentioned, there are teams that could make offers and then pivot if those offers end up getting matched. So, I think that would probably be what I'd be looking at is 20 million a year. Maybe I'd go up to 21 with Gordon, but it's really tough when he doesn't have, to me, that offensive superstar upside. And you just don't know if he just would have to be so good defensively to justify that kind of contract. And he has that capability, but it's tough. So, I mean, maybe if he gets above that and there really is that offer out there, you could maybe try to work a sign and trade, but it's gonna be tough. So I think that would be, I would say, and then if he gets a better offer than 5 years, 100 million, then all right, you got to kind of figure it out at that point and see what else has happened around the league. But I think I wouldn't go beyond that before there's an offer sheet.
And I'm going to be interested with guys like Gordon. I think he is probably the best example of this. Jabari could be in that mix too, of how much they talk with teams that don't have cap space. That, because Orlando could facilitate a lot of different kinds of deals if they wanted to, if they were amenable. And I would kind of just be like, hey, if you want to do that. The problem as Orlando with the tactics of it is by opening it up, you make it less likely that he stays because that more suitors means more variance. And more opportunity to have a team, or not more variance, but more opportunities to have a team that loves him. But if they could get something for that, maybe get another asset, take on some bad money, it could be another way to build the team instead of committing to a player who limits your flexibility and certainly makes you a better team, but might not really be the centerpiece of the next great Magic squad that comes out.
All right, that's probably, I guess one more thing I want to say on Gordon too, just as a general comment on restricted free agency, is we saw this with Nerlens last year, right? Because it's boom or bust if the guy rejects the initial offer and actually gets out there on the marketplace as a restricted free agent, right? Remember the Mavs famously offered that 5 for 70 at the beginning of restricted free agency and Nerlens turned it down. And then he ended up firing his agent, Happy Walsers. He ended up going with the Rich Paul and they took the qualifying offer. You can say as a team, hey, this offer, we're making this at the start of restricted free agency. This is, we've got some risk here, but you also have some risk. And so if you reject it, it's either match an offer sheet or we're going to lower our offer. You can say that as a negotiation, But I think that you always have to be mindful of the possibility. And obviously for Dallas, it was great that Nerlens didn't accept that. But you got to be mindful of the possibility that this guy's going to get in his feelings a little bit and just say, hey, you made that offer before. Now it's not there. Like, I'm not going to take anything less. And I mean, there's so many aspects to me of the restricted free agency and rookie extension process that are handled irrationally by players and agents. But you still have to kind of be aware of that as a team that, yeah, okay, you can make that offer and say this is only on the table for X amount of time. But realistically, if you really significantly lower your offer after that, like, the guy's just going to be pissed off. He probably isn't going to sign it. Or if he is, he's going to be angry that he's there still and that you lowered your offer on him. Like, there is still that anchoring that comes from that initial offer.
I have a couple other just kind of housekeeping notes with this team. Shelvin Mack has a $6 million non-guarantee, which is before free agency starts. I would expect that he'll be gone.
Now, that is, however, minimum. Note that that is actually $1 million guaranteed. Which is,
oh, it is, yeah, $1 million. I had it as non-guaranteed.
Pincus tweeted it out initially, but I think maybe he just didn't get a chance to update it on his actual sheet. But yeah, that is $1 million guaranteed until 4 days after the draft. So that is, he will not be on the Magic after.
Okay.
And also worth noting that for him, because he signed that contract under the new CBA, that just trading him away, he would count, the outgoing salary would be different than the incoming salary. It makes it really difficult to trade him unless you guarantee that. So you can't do the whole, oh, we'll trade him away and we'll take back $6 million in salary, you know, as a way to help another team dump salary. You can't do that anymore unless it was a guy who was signed on the previous CBA, like a Cole Aldrich. So that's an important note. Very, very unlikely. Now, hopefully they will not make the same mistake that they made with CJ Watson and stretch his $1 million guarantee the way they did last year, which was pretty asinine. It's not a huge deal. It's only $333,000, but there's just zero reason. Now, I guess, you know, if they lose Gordon, they would have about $17 million in cap space, but it'll be so late in the process by then, most likely, that, you know, they'll probably end up just holding on to it or maybe taking on bad money with it. I don't think they're going to be really like, oh, we need this extra $666,000 in cap space by stretching Shelvin Mack's $1 million guarantee.
Yeah, there have been a few others of those too. Like, Kevin Martin got stretched by the Wolves in a weird way. Matt Barnes, we talked about with Sack. There are a couple other ones. But so the other non-guarantees they have, Ken Birch and Rodney Purvis. I liked what we saw from Ken Birch last year, just at the minimum, assuming they're not going to be needing to squeeze every dollar out.
He guarantees early.
And then
Ken Birch, he's a 6'29". So, yeah. Again, I think really where they're at right now, you know, they're not going to run into the tax line. You might as well just guarantee that. See if he can work out.
Yeah, I mean, they'll have the flexibility. They could just cut him if they don't think he's good. I mean, it wouldn't really sacrifice too much. But the most interesting free agent other than Aaron Gordon is my good friend Mario Hezonja. And so Hezonja is the less famous version of what's happening currently with Kevon Looney, which is when you decline an option, you cannot pay a player more than that option amount. The big difference between those two gentlemen is that Hezonja's hold and his maximum is $5.2 million, which is a lot of money and more than enough probably to pay him, you know, what he would get somewhere else. So I would be interested in bringing him back potentially. I would also think, you know, other teams could be as well, but don't break the bank for Hezonja, especially considering it looked like his best position was the four, and that is not a position of need for this Magic team. So, you know, maybe if he doesn't really have anything and for 1 year you can bring him back just on the chance that you'll have full bird rights after that sort of thing. But if somebody makes him a good multi-year offer, just let him go.
Yeah, that seems and you know, I think he still has some issues with the organization. He gave an interview in which he was asked what the difference was between his previous years and last one, when he showed a slight amount of promise. One of them was that he was playing the four a lot, but also he basically just said playing time and nothing else. So it seems like he's going to be looking for wherever the largest available role is. And, you know, maybe they bring him back, but he is not of this regime. And you could certainly see him letting him go. And obviously they declined his option for a reason to begin with. Where do you think they could go as far as using the full mid-level if they decided? You mentioned Dante Exum, Fred VanVleet. Any other options that stick out to you there?
If they want to win now, they would be an intriguing make good Isaiah Thomas destination, because they actually have starting point guard minutes available unless they draft one. I mentioned Wayne Ellington a little bit earlier. He'd be intriguing. I think he overlaps too much with Fournier. Those are two guys that are more shooting guard only. They can't really switch a whole lot. But, and I mean, I don't think Mbamute, I mean, it would be very interesting to actually, you'd get a good test of what Aaron Gordon is defensively, because if you had Mbamute and Gordon together, you know, how they handle those assignments, who does Gordon defend well, that would be interesting. The problem is I wouldn't really want to go on a big multi-year deal with Mbamute because his age-wise, he doesn't really line up with what they're doing. That's more for me a calibrator of like, okay, this is Weltman and Hammond going a little bit more aggressively for the present.
Yeah, the aforementioned Looney actually could be an interesting fit as a center if they wanted to go to more of a switch everything alignment, depending on who they draft, if they keep around both Isaac and Gordon. And I'm talking about kind of more now for these, hey, my idea of let's break up the MLE and try and bring in some other guys. Some of the backup point guards who are restricted free agents, like Shabazz Napier would want to go back there. Maybe Yogi Ferrell could be an interesting one. If Teodosic becomes a free agent, they could be an interesting destination for him. He's a guy who might help make them a little bit more entertaining, but hopefully not win too many games. But they really just need some good pick and roll play. A guy as a shooter. Hey, Alfred Payton is a restricted free agent. Just kidding.
Well, you're not kidding that he is a restricted free agent. And also, we should mention that's part of why Orlando has a little bit more flexibility is because they don't have to worry about paying him either, you know, a pre-free agency contract or matching or whatever. Yeah. Not that his value is super high right now. But also, so this is something I wanted to bring up because I brought this up in my Reddit for The Athletic. You don't want to rush it with a point guard. You don't want to force it because we just saw with Orlando what happens when you draft a point guard and they end up not being exactly what you need because it's the idea of kind of being pot committed. It's a logical fallacy. Teams shouldn't do it as much as they do, but you foreclose on other opportunities because you're like, hey, let's see how Alfred Payton works out. So if they don't feel that, you know, let's say Trae Young's off the board or they don't feel that he's the right solution, there are problems with trying to fit it in and when the player isn't worth it.
Well, and I mean, for next year, this is such an ugly point guard market that, you know, there really aren't any starting caliber point guards unless Isaiah Thomas is going to be healthy that they can bring in. You know, I mean, it's really would have to be DJ Augustin. You know, there's Rondo, there's Derrick Rose, who actually might be able to help this team a little bit if he could stay healthy. But, you know, he's too old really for what they're talking about. You know, Seth Curry could be an interesting one as a guy who maybe, you know, you could bring him in and let him try and fill it up and be a guy who could build some value. He's still young enough to do that, kind of a distressed asset at this point coming off that injury.
Well, and with Seth, if you can pay him at the price where it's a reasonable backup guard price eventually, then you could slide him into that role once you get somebody better than him in case it doesn't work out. I like Seth Curry a lot as a second unit guy if necessary.
Yeah, I think also, you know, given some of the defensive, at least potential that they have in their front court and on the wing, Doug McDermott might be someone that they could look at a little bit. Rodney Hood, who you'll recall just absolutely lit up the Magic last season. Probably, you know, obviously so much is in flux in Cleveland, but you'd imagine Cleveland probably matches if there's an offer sheet with the MLE there for Hood. Maybe not if LeBron sticks around, interestingly enough, but probably if he leaves, they would. That's about all I got here. Pat McCaw could be an interesting one for them too, maybe.
That's exactly what I was going to say. I think McCaw could be intriguing. And they could, you know, they could maybe throw something at like Davis Bertans, yeah, just as a kind of another, like as a kind of a different version of McDermott.
Yeah. Ty Wallace, maybe, who's a restricted free agent as a two-way guy, showed some promise, a guy maybe who can give them some energy. You know, the fact that he can't shoot makes him a little bit of a tough fit, but, you know, that's one maybe they could think of. Just another guy who's 25, just get some young talent that could develop on the roster and it would hopefully be a nice contract.
Yeah, and it would be very interesting to see if they theoretically did your idea, which I support but don't think will happen, about kind of clearing house. They could actually go in some interesting directions on kind of like 1 year testing out guy spots is on the big line or whatever, but it's just they have too many centers because there's so much value there at the center spot, but it's just that they don't really need it at the moment.
All right, we spent 45 minutes on the Magic. I think that is enough. A little bit of news. We can probably just save that till tomorrow. Oh, wow, you had something?
Oh, I want reactions. Okay. I don't know, because while we were recording, a piece of news happened.
Okay, what is it?
Rudy Gay declined his player option for next season.
Man, they are jumping off that sinking ship fast, aren't they?
And that's also fascinating from a financial perspective for Rudy Gay. We just talked about how few teams have the full MLE to offer. That's basically what his declined option was for a single season. And so maybe he would like less than that, but for more years. But
I think he wants to just go somewhere to win. I mean, you remember he turned down that Sacramento option, which was a lot. And maybe he just feels like with Kawhi wanting out, that that's not really an option for him as much in San Antonio anymore. And for the Spurs, that's difficult if they, you know, they really need someone who can score on the perimeter. They just don't have that right now. And that does give them a little bit more flexibility. Presumably Gay is not opting out, so he can go back there. I mean, I guess they could make him an offer, but they actually, you know, Danny Green is the next domino to fall there in San Antonio. We'll see though. I mean, obviously this is all subsidiary to the Kawhi thing, but, you know, probably Gay signs elsewhere. And for Gay, I think he will be in demand. He is one of the few guys who really can fill it up off the bench in this free agent class. So I think there will be a demand for him, especially because he showed a little bit more defensively this season as well. And at 31, looked pretty good coming back from the Achilles. So I think there'll be a market for him above the MLE. It seems pretty unlikely because there just aren't winning teams that need someone like him. But, you know, if he is opting out and he's just okay with taking the full taxpayer MLE, there'll be a lot of teams who will want his services there. And I think he'd be a good value at that number. I think that this really is about winning more than it is maximizing money for Ree, though.
Yeah, that very well could be. And it'll be fascinating to see what he prioritizes, what teams offer him, let's say the full MLE. So,
and,
yeah,
and maybe the Spurs will just offer, you know, would just bring him back for more money on this, on another
20% raise or whatever.
Probably at a minimum, they'd be willing to do that because I don't see them going into tank mode this year.
No, I don't either.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. Since we're doing a little bit of news, Mark Stein with just some lottery trade buzz saying that the Kings are actually weighing taking Porter at number two. Now that's per rival executives. So why would rival executives be in any better position to know that than Stein himself would be? Who knows? I mean, everybody's got their intel and ways of getting it, how reliable that is, whether that's eighth hand information or from agents or what, you know, who knows how reliable that is. And then Memphis, this was a rather cryptic tweet. I'm not sure what type of a conception this trade would take, but Memphis is apparently looking to move Parsons and number four while still staying in the high lottery. And so that occurred to me as, well, Chandler Parsons, one of the most toxic contracts, maybe the most toxic contract in the NBA at this point, you know, over $25 million a year the next two seasons for a guy who, you know, hasn't been able to stay on the floor and at best might be able to play a little backup combo forward with his health concerns. I mean, maybe what that would be is, because no, I don't think anybody, if you're sitting at like six or seven, or you're the Bulls or the Magic, you're not willing to take on that Parsons contract just to move up two or three slots, right? So something's got to be coming back to Memphis in that. That's also maybe bad salary, but not as bad, or maybe it's, you know, just for 1 year or something. But even that seems like more value than Memphis should expect.
Yeah, I mean, especially considering how little flexibility a lot of these teams have, I think that would be a lot to expect, but we'll see. And that's part of the reason I love the draft so much, is that you get these, you get to see what GMs really prioritize and how they value it. And yeah, it'll be a lot to check in on moving forward. Anything else? I'll plug a couple things.
Yeah, there's before. Actually Tanya Ganguly out of LA with the LA Times said, and this was reporting with Broderick Turner as well, according to sources, the Clippers would be willing to create a package, including Tobias Harris, who, by the way, is an expiring contract, and either the 12th or 13th, not both, pick in this year's draft in a potential Kawhi Leonard trade. And then she also confirmed that Kawhi is most interested in going to the Lakers, that presumably coming from his camp. Or maybe it could actually be coming from the Lakers too, who's been told that by his camp. You know, that could be it. But I think that's interesting. Tobias Harris on the 12th or 13th pick. You know, if the Clippers believe that that's a realistic offer, you know, this is what we talked about yesterday of, hey, maybe these offers are not going to be that amazing. You know, now certainly if you're Philly or you're Boston, you can beat that offer very easily. If they threw in both 12 and 13, now maybe it gets more interesting, but then, you know, it becomes more difficult. And I think that would be sort of the, hey, we still want to compete as the Spurs. Harris is probably a guy that they could get a lot out of. And I mean, it is worth noting that completely without Kawhi Leonard and with a huge hole in his position, they won 47 games last year. Now, I think most of their guys are on the downside, but you know, you could see the Spurs in the 45 to 50 win range if they were to get Harris back. And obviously, if Greg Popovich were still coaching it at his best, which, you know, it is understandably a little bit of a question with the personal tragedy that he's undergone. All right. Now I think we're done. If you want to plug some stuff.
So 28 of my 30 previews are out for The Athletic, my off-season previews. The 29th, the Los Angeles Lakers will probably be coming out in the next, it might be out by the time this comes out, for the recently launched Athletic Los Angeles. So that'll be exciting. Also wrote a piece over the weekend about the kind of the way the Warriors should think about their roster slots in terms of regular season versus playoffs. And then a primer on the cap part of the Kawhi situation. I didn't get into any trade suitors or anything like that. Those are all up at The Athletic, and hoping to do a bunch more stuff. I mean, and we're obviously going to do more draft material, so people can look forward to that.
Yeah, we're going to roll through some more film, kind of do some of our quick hitters, and then we'll do our draft board as well later in the week. So lots more fun stuff coming, and then obviously the draft. It's only 3 days away. Wait, it's going to be awesome. We'll talk to y'all on Tuesday night. Till then.